My guest today is Mike Lofgren. Today we're going to talk about a subject near and dear to me, which is trying to break apart American politics. Mike's book, his new book, is titled The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution, and the Rise of a Shadow Government. In a world where everyone thinks their vote matters, in a world where everyone thinks the next politician that gets elected will solve their particular problem and fix the country, Mike has a counter to that style of thinking, that, in my opinion, wrong style of thinking. There really is forces, concerns, organizations, corporations that are far more powerful than any of the nitwits we elect to go to Washington, D.C. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Mike Lofgren. So, Mike, even though I'm calling you from a communist country in Asia today, I actually own property in Vienna, Virginia. I grew up in Vienna, and I'm intimately aware of the Beltway scene. Gosh, if I think back to the 1980s, a place like Vienna would have had just typical 1950s, 60s split-level homes, a lot of government employees, but not a huge amount of wealth. And then, boom, we're now in a completely different situation. That's a little bit of the setup, so you know where I'm coming from, just on my background. To start with this, though, I want to read something from your work, The Deep State, which I really think sets this up nicely. This is from your work. By the end of my career, I considered myself a resolute nonpartisan and increasingly viewed all political ideologies as mental and emotional crutches or substitute religions. For leaders, a means of manipulating attitudes and behaviors. For the rank and file, a lazy surrogate for problem solving and a way of fulfilling the craving to belong to something bigger than oneself. That is a really fantastic couple of sentences. And it's like, I mean, anybody out there that still has a pulse in them probably wants to give you a hug for writing those sentences.
I think what it does is describe my own career path. I tried to view myself, certainly I was working within a party system in Congress. At the end of the day, I was a professional having to deal with federal budgets. The numbers were what the numbers were. You can't fake them. And these people who continuously, for three decades, pretended that tax cuts increase revenue when they do the opposite, or that our intervention in the Middle East will solve the problem when it only increases the problem. It creates a kind of hydra-headed mess. These people are no longer responding to reality and experience and empirical evidence. They're simply responding to an ideological fantasy, which is kind of indistinguishable from a fundamentalist religion.
Let's define things from the beginning so people have a feeling of your terminology. The deep state is what exactly?
People elected George W. Bush with certain expectations, and perhaps the more ideologically engaged of them saw him fulfill their expectations of tax cuts and unilateral military power. Of course, it got us into a mess, and there was a lot of rethinking. So we elected Barack Obama on the promise of hope and change. Yet this candidate who campaigned against the surge in Iraq, against illegal surveillance, against most of the policies that Bush had instituted, ended up continuing many of them. His Secretary of Defense, arguably the most important cabinet member in his government, was Bob Gates, precisely an old Bush family consigliere who presided over the surge in Iraq. John Brennan, a CIA official in the Bush administration, became CIA director under Barack Obama. Victoria Nuland, the infamous instigator of the hacked phone call in Kiev, who arguably was behind the coup in Kiev in 2014 that set us at loggerheads with Russia was a foreign policy advisor of Dick Cheney. Now, how is it that two opposite people are formally running the government, yet the people they choose for sort of the permanent government are the same people? And you see this suffused throughout our governmental structure. It's the same Wall Street types, whether it's Tim Geithner or Hank Paulson as Secretary of the Treasury. They're essentially birds of a feather. I call this phenomenon the deep state, both for that and the fact that the governmental parts, particularly of the national security state and the finance portion of the government, are intimately connected with the military-industrial complex, Silicon Valley for surveillance, and of course Wall Street for financing and for careers.
And so the deep state, for people to start to wrap their arms around them, you position it as a shadow government. But it's not, as you say, you don't view it as a conspiracy theory. You look at this more as a gradual accumulation of power, prestige, whatnot, that started after World War II. Why don't you explain that a little bit, bringing us up to perhaps 9/11, post-World War II, up to 9/11, and kind of touch on the big targets of how things started to unfold.
Well, first of all, I'll reiterate that it's not a conspiracy. In fact, when you say something is a conspiracy, then it's pure death as far as getting it taken seriously. And it doesn't have to be. These are things that happen in the light of day. Most of the characters, their names are publicly accessible. Their goings on are reported in the newspapers. There's simply a tremendous amount of continuity of people following what they perceive as their own interest, and they rationalize it as the national interest. It started probably, I would say, in World War II, where you had the Manhattan Project to build the atomic bomb. This was the biggest, most expensive, and most secret project ever. They built entire cities from scratch, like Hanford, Washington, Los Alamos, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that nobody outside the workers knew about. Congress didn't know about it. Congress didn't know it was appropriating the money for it. President Truman, when he was vice president, had no clue about the bomb. He had to be briefed on it by the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, the day after he became president. So this kind of set a baseline for secrecy and extravagance and projects that it was best the American public didn't know about. It set a tremendous precedent. Of course, these structures grew during the Cold War to the point where Eisenhower, who presided over it for two terms in his farewell address, warned us about the rise of disastrously misplaced power known as the military-industrial complex. Now, I would say the turmoil of the Vietnam War, the urban riots, the revelations about the CIA and the Church Committee in the late 60s and early 70s was a potential inflection point where we could have gotten control of the thing. But I think during the Reagan administration, the forces pushed back. We had things like Iran-Contra, which showed essentially a plot to subvert the Constitution. Nobody was seriously punished, and it's rolled forward ever since. After 9/11, it went on steroids. In the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, which I call Beltway Land, since 9/11, I think we've built the equivalent of seven pentagons in terms of square footage for national security purposes, whether it be the Pentagon, NSA, Homeland Security, etc., CIA, since 9/11.
True or false, Mike? Quick statement from me. Elections don't matter all the way down to the local town council level. From the president to Congress to state elections, gubernatorial, down to the town council level. Does it matter anymore?
It matters on the margin. I would say that Barack Obama is not George Bush, although his policies are very similar. I think we would be in up to our ears in Syria with major ground forces if we had Hillary Clinton elected in 2008 rather than Barack Obama. So yes, it matters on the margin, but the general vector of movement, the general vector of who gets what in our society, what the general distribution of income is, what our foreign policy looks like in general, is going to be pretty much the same. Now, I would say Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, respectively, are severely testing that thesis simply because income distribution has become so out of whack. People have become so tired of foreign policy and what they view as inequitable trade policy. If you look at free trade, every so-called responsible economist, usually from chairs endowed by big business at our universities, is going to say it's great. Well, they don't know any workers who've lost their job. They don't know the assembly line worker in Toledo. I think we may have reached an inflection point where there's broad consciousness. They can't necessarily connect the dots. They can't analyze it in an intellectual way, but the public knows something is wrong. The Trump and Sanders candidacies, however disparate they are, however they may or may not succeed, they have shaken up the political structure. They have certainly frightened the daylights out of what I call the permanent campaign finance military industrial complex. All these consultants, pollsters, gurus who made a fat living around the Beltway, just as defense contractors have, from the party systems, because they have completely different business models for raising money. Sanders gets over a million contributions of $30 each, and Trump, by his own very modest estimation, is richer than God. So he doesn't need a lot of contributions from rich people. So I think what you're seeing with Hillary, what you're seeing with the Republican National Committee, is the forces of the establishment pushing back very aggressively at what they see as a mortal threat to the status quo.
You know, you mentioned the Beltway land, the area where I think you live right now, where I grew up. I tell you, I always say that if, I think it's like 5 or 6 of the top 10 wealthiest counties surround D.C. And people, you tell that to people around America, they just kind of shake their head. They don't get it. It's just these government jobs are just amazing how much money they spend. The amount of money that circulates and comes from the being a, either a contractor or working for the government, just flat out amazing. And the McMansions in that area, I think people just can't, they can't wrap their arms around it unless they see it. I want to go back to something you were talking about, though. So if I look at something like the exploding national debt, you could see standards of living are not exactly going up. You see, you talked about the decline of U.S. manufacturing, retirement income. First, we had zero interest rates, and now we're about to go to negative interest rates. You know, the educational system. Do you trace all of this to the deep state?
My distinction is I'm not looking just at the military industrial complex. I'm not looking just at Wall Street the way Michael Lewis might look at it in The Big Short. I consider them integral parts of a bigger ecosystem. The same system that invaded Iraq is the same system that exploded our deficit, both through the tax cuts for the rich and the military expending. Notice in all our previous wars, we had income tax increases or tax surcharges or some way to finance the war. The invasion of Iraq was the first major war where George Bush, rather than asking for sacrifice, told citizens to go shopping. And then he gave them a tax cut, which simply magnified the budget deficit. Now, one point I'd like to make is it's not actually the government workers who are living in the McMansions. They have capped salaries. And in fact, the government workforce is no bigger than it was at the time of John F. Kennedy, when we had little more than half the population in the country. So the per capita number of federal workers has actually gone down. Yet people say, well, where's all this spending coming from? It goes to contractors. There's no cap on their salaries. There's no limit to their profits. So the outsourcing of government contracts is primarily how people get rich. And of course, these people living out in Loudoun County sort of think of themselves as a kind of free Jeffersonian squirearchy living out there in the old former Hunt country of Virginia. But hey, they're living off the government every bit as much as a government worker, and they're getting a lot richer.
Let me go into Wall Street. You worked for John Kasich?
I sure did.
Let me offer up a little quote here, which I think is interesting from your work. And so I guess years back after Kasich left Congress, he went to Lehman Brothers. I don't hear this much on CNN or anything these days, but he went to Lehman Brothers, took a job there. You quote a very flattering picture that he painted of Dick Fuld. Dick Fuld, who you can easily argue, had a tremendous amount to do with what happened in the fall of 2008. And so as he took that job, he said, quote, "Fuld is an awesome guy. He's the kind of guy you want to go to battle with. He's a great leader. I like people who are really smart and who are great leaders." That's an amazing quote. I mean, and this guy's actually got some people in the country interested in voting for him today. You would think that quote alone would tell somebody with a modicum of intelligence, what is this guy doing around? This guy is so full of it. Am I completely in the wrong direction?
For a little background for your listeners, Dick Fuld was the CEO of Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers' collapse was the biggest corporate bankruptcy in world history, and it set off the September 2008 financial meltdown, the biggest global financial meltdown since the stock market crash of 1929. Fuld arguably was the worst guy on Wall Street in a whole menagerie of sociopaths. He was known as the gorilla. And he leveraged Lehman something like 40 to 1. He resisted attempts to deleverage or to sell out while the getting was good. You'll notice Hank Paulson took pretty good care of his buddies on Wall Street, Goldman and the other banks and AIG even. Hank Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury under Bush. But he left Lehman out in the cold. Although there was a lot of bad feeling from Fuld that this was personal animus from Paulson, I can understand it, because if there was, you know, only so much room in the lifeboat that the Treasury was providing and somebody had to be left in the water for the sharks, that guy was going to be Fuld. Unlike Kasich, I don't think Fuld was an awesome guy.
Talk a little bit more about that. I mean, that's really remarkable. I mean, there's so the way that people inside the deep state move, they move laterally back and forth from politics to corporate, from politics to banking. It's like a merry-go-round or a revolving door, a turnstile. It never stops. And then when they go back to being a politician, this the whole thing of they're the man of the people again. I think you're right that with Trump and Sanders, the public might not understand all the details, but they smell something is up. And Trump and Sanders might not be perfect messengers by any stretch, but they're giving people a chance to say, hey, this stuff doesn't smell right.
Well, that's absolutely correct. I think for years, decades, the strategy has been as these people have moved. And for instance, Jeb Bush after he left the governorship of Florida, he became a consultant for Lehman Brothers, among others. So this is really common to sort of tie in the military-industrial complex with Wall Street. David Petraeus, after he left the CIA somewhat in disgrace for leaking code word level information to his mistress, ended up as a partner at Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, KKR, of Manhattan, a leveraged buyout firm. Now, I wasn't aware that being the greatest general, supposedly, since Alexander the Great, actually gave you qualifications in leveraged buyouts on Wall Street. But, of course, the reason they hired the guy was as a door opener in Washington. What these people all count on is short memories by the public, and a public that's so turned off and apathetic that they don't really pay attention. And I'd have to say our commercial media, which in the last 30 years has gone down from about 50 or so major companies to around half a dozen, they have no interest in stirring any of this up. Their job is to sell Budweiser and Corn Flakes. And they do that by talking about Kim Kardashian or whether Tom Brady deflated a football, or something like that. A complex story about where your money went, where the personnel went from the Hill to Wall Street, and then back to a governorship or a presidential candidate. That sort of complex follow the money thing takes a long attention span, and it takes good investigative reporting. And they're not going to provide that.
Mike, I thought you had a great example with Lindsey Graham, who I find one of the most, I used to like him when he was younger and in Congress. He seemed to have some kind of a spine, but he has become something older in age that is just, he seems to be part and parcel, like a deep state spokesman. I mean, it's like he might as well have a label on his chest that says deep state. I would love for you to talk about the example with Sheldon Adelson, the internet gambling legislation, because I thought the connection with Graham was a really great story to give the people listening an insight as to how the sausage is made.
Lindsey Graham has been a federal elected official since about, I think, 1995, first in the House and now in the Senate. Suddenly in 2014, he introduces legislation to ban internet gambling. Now, who does this benefit? It benefits people who own casinos. Foremost among them, Sheldon Adelson, who in 2014 started showering money on elected officials, PAC money. Funny how the first time that Lindsey Graham receives money from Sheldon Adelson, he runs out and introduces a bill to ban internet gambling. Now, that seems almost like a quid pro quo, although I suppose Justice John Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, would say it's not a strict quid pro quo. And Lindsey Graham would, of course, tell you, well, you know, his Baptist constituents in South Carolina, they think gambling is a sin. Well, that may be, but he was not driven to introduce such legislation for the previous almost 20 years until Sheldon Adelson started showering him with money.
But this is par for the course. I mean, this has been going on for a long time, and I think probably today what we can safely say is that it's reached levels and peaks that we've never seen. And I would love for you to also make the connection. I told you that I'm calling from Asia. I happen to be in a communist country, but as you know, there's plenty of communist countries in Asia that operate extremely capitalistic on the ground. And I think it would cause many Americans that have never been to kind of go, wow, they're really merchants. But the government structures for some of these countries, clearly there's no control by the people. There's no real voting. They're lucky, perhaps, if their leaders send them in the right direction. I wonder how you feel about that, connecting back to voting mattering or not. What's the difference? Like, I mean, how can we in America sit back and lament and say, well, look at the Chinese form of government. It's communist. You know, they don't have, the people don't have any control. And I look at what we've become in America, and I have a hard time, except for labels, I have a hard time understanding how we're truly different these days.
I'm not going to denigrate the fact that we do have a Bill of Rights. Sometimes it's honored in the breach more than the observance. If you look at the Fourth Amendment prohibition against illegal search and seizure vis-a-vis the National Security Agency. Nevertheless, we do have protections that an independent or relatively independent court recognizes. Now, that said, these are legacies of the past. These are being eroded over time by the fact that what we have is a kind of oligarchy that's grown up that maintains the original form of the government we have, with voting and elections, separation of powers, and so forth. But the choices we get tend to be Coke or Pepsi, because the way the oligarchs seem to have had it wired last year was it's going to be Jeb Bush versus Hillary Clinton. Now it's beginning to look like, yes, we'll get Hillary Clinton, very hawkish, pro-Wall Street, corporate Democrat, but that's typically how the oligarchy tries to manipulate the system. Yes, we can go to the polls. Yes, we can make differences on the margin, but it's not all that great. You have a certain measure of popular control in communist China. If the corruption of the local party oligarchs gets too great and the public gets roiled, then they take cognizance of it in Beijing and they hold their periodic campaigns to clean up corruption. But it's mostly a cosmetic operation.
Let's talk about the Fed for a few minutes. I look at what happened 2008, 2009. I see the QE policy from the Fed. I see extremely low interest rates, as I mentioned earlier, going negative soon. Was this all just a massive backdoor bailout for the banks and for the brokerage firms and whatnot? And do you see, is that the Fed's clearly a part of the deep state as well, right?
Definitely the case. Now, if part of this is due to the fact that these people are all educated in the same schools in economics and business, they all have the same template for how to solve problems. They say to the man with the hammer, everything looks like a nail. They have a limited palette of things that they can do because they can't conceive of anything else. Now, obviously, we're going to have to engage in some sort of a rescue operation for the economy, and the Fed would play a significant role in that. Maybe they should have recapitalized the banks. In so doing, they should have replaced the ownership and the executives, because in getting the federal money, that should have been the deal. Anybody working in the bank at an executive capacity, there would be a salary cap. There'd be some mandatory measure to write down loans. So you wouldn't be just helping the banks. You'd be preventing foreclosures on Main Street, not just helping Wall Street. But the sort of policy recipe they came up with was sort of very predictable type of thing that just bailed out Wall Street, gave them impunity, very low interest rates that they could get money and arbitrage it and make money from money. So now they've recovered very quickly, whereas Main Street has not. Essentially, they were the lever that got Wall Street back on its feet.
Mike, why are there no whistleblowers? I mean, like I mentioned, I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. I have sent and gone through the FOIA process, the Freedom of Information process. I've gone through that at the town, the state, and the federal level. I've gotten many documents that probably would have been buried forever. In some ways, I guess that's kind of a form of citizen whistleblower. It's amazing that the only whistleblowing that I've heard of in the last bunch of years would be Snowden and this guy Assange locked up in what the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And these two guys have been pillared and just tarred and feathered for literally years and years and years. Where is Snowden hiding out in Russia, I believe, still? Why in the world, with all of these so-called public servants, government workers, they clearly see, they see documents and they see insights that I think if the average person saw, they would go, wow, that is truly amazing that this is going on. And it's up and down from the local to the state to the federal level. The level of odd stuff going on and bad behavior exists up and down the system, the food chain. Why do we have no whistleblowers? Why does no one come clean, seemingly ever?
They don't want to end up in jail. There's an executive order issued in 2009 by the Obama administration about secrecy and classification that says, reasonably enough, that criminality or fraud or waste cannot be a rationale for classifying something. Nevertheless, what we've seen under the insider threat program is more employees prosecuted or attempted to be prosecuted under the Espionage Act of 1917 than all previous administrations combined, which gives you a clue as to the cluelessness of people who said, well, why didn't Snowden just bring this to the, you know, up the chain of command rather than steal it? Because he didn't want to be charged under the Espionage Act and put away potentially for 30 years in prison. The NSA, I know two or three people personally who were involved, who saw a sort of homebrewed house system that worked very well in surveillance and potential terrorists, but would protect the rights of American citizens. And that was thrown overboard for this vastly more expensive system developed by SAIC, an outside contractor that didn't protect your privacy and was less effective. But that was the corporate decision at NSA, and when these people objected, they were charged with the Espionage Act. In the case of Thomas Drake, the presiding judge was scathing about the thing when the NSA, the Justice Department prosecutors, were going to charge him with espionage. And then once the trial came up, they had such a flimsy case that they reduced it to a misdemeanor of storing classified information on a private computer. And it was retroactively classified, I might add. So the judge said, this is ridiculous. But the problem was the damage was done. He'd lost his job. He was destitute because of legal fees. And he was made an object lesson for any other employee of the NSA.
If you take the money to be an employee of the government, the pressures, and there's a lot of different types of pressures, but the pressures to do the right thing don't exist.
In theory, they do, but in practice, they don't. It's get with the program.
We've kind of touched on it a little bit. I want to dive back into it. You know, look, this is the first, I think it's probably the first time in the history of America, basically got an entire generation of people, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, folks over 100 years of age, they were told, if you save your money, you're going to have a certain amount of interest income. Now we're looking at, you know, clearly all the way back to the dot-com bubble, but especially the last 8 years, there's been no interest income. We're about to go to negative interest income. Mike, if I look at the last 15 years of deep state activities, if I look at the way the interest rate curve has been manipulated, And if I look at a situation that every time we have extremely low rates and a very high stock market, usually something bad happens.
Right, because there's no stable way to get a little bit of interest income. It forces money into things like equities and real estate and creates bubbles in those, just as it created a, from Alan Greenspan, artificially lowering the interest rate after 9/11 was one of the factors, not the only one, but one of the factors leading to the housing bubble. So yeah, there's something wrong with it. In a sense, it becomes a tremendous economic distortion that's almost the mirror image of the stagflation of the 1970s, where you had persistent high interest rates that were also harming the economy and distorting it.
Mike, I want to go into the Middle East a little bit. I know we're jumping subjects, but look, the way that your work is outlined and laid out, all of these things tie together. I mean, this apparatus, this deep state apparatus is involved in so many things. But let's go into the Middle East a little bit, and let's talk about this, the military industrial complex, especially the notion of I must have a war on. If there's not a conflict, create a conflict. But if you can also dovetail that in and connect it with some of the current headlines that I'm seeing right now, and you talk about this some in your work, Saudi Arabia, this missing 28 pages. Why don't you give the audience some perspective about this need to create war and perhaps shine a little light from your perspective on what you might know about 9/11? Because it seems like we're about to learn things that we really did not want to learn, and perhaps soon.
Well, the connection between the Saudi royal family and the oligarchy here is very deep. It goes back, in fact, to 1945, the meeting between the Saudi king and President Roosevelt on the cruiser Augusta in the Red Sea. We're not quite sure what was exactly in that agreement, but we can infer that it was kind of a carte blanche grant of protection to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia if they would keep pumping oil. Now, this deepened in the 1970s after Nixon cut the link between the dollar and gold. The dollar was plummeting, and there was perhaps thought in sight that the dollar could cease being the world reserve currency. But we roped in the Saudis as a way of maintaining the dollar as the world reserve currency by an agreement that they would sort of faithfully recycle the petrodollars that they got from oil back into the New York money markets and occasionally make, you know, multi-billion dollar purchases of arms. And this has become kind of a self-licking ice cream cone, a perpetual motion machine that keeps the dollar, the world reserve currency, even though we're running persistent trade and current account deficits, and it allows us to keep interest rates low so that we can finance that debt. So there's a lot of reasons beyond just their having the oil that they're kind of a prop to the deep state. The notion that elements in Saudi Arabia might have been cognizant, might have been complicit in 9/11 is definitely something the Bush family or the Cheney with their oil connections wouldn't want to see come out. The interesting thing is that we're now in the eighth year of Barack Obama's presidency, and only now are they talking about declassifying that 28 pages. I don't think we'll be really that surprised that there's collusion or at least private connections to rich people or rich elements in Saudi Arabia and Al-Qaeda, because they've been financing jihadist movements since the 1970s, some of it at our behest.
Let me dig into Obama a little bit. We've talked about Bush. We've talked about Obama a little bit. I remember back to that campaign season when he won his first election to be president against McCain. You know, he had these great rallies. There was this fantastic energy. So many young people were going out, and there was a real spin and the kind of hope and change stuff. And it obviously fell short. And now you start to wonder, has that same audience, that's why they're so recalcitrant and so diehard on Sanders. And you hear those Sanders supporters say, if Hillary gets it, we're not going for her. It's almost like they see we were burned by Obama. It didn't work out. And now we're gonna ride Sanders. And if he doesn't work out, we're gone. I want to bring Obama up because, you know, he seems like, I probably have different politics than he does. But, you know, he was a U.S. senator from Illinois. He got elected to be president. He had this platform of hope and change. And as you've mentioned also in this conversation, literally nothing has changed. And things you could only argue have gotten worse on just about every front. What happened? Was he just – did he get inside? Did he know the system was there before he got there? Or did he get inside and realize that he literally was just going to be another piece – of the deep state and really had no control? Or did he just not care?
I can't do mind reading, but I can infer from what I saw. I'm not particularly, disillusioned or disappointed, because I saw what happened before he even became president. In early 2008, he not only said he would oppose any legislation to retroactively indemnify the telecommunications companies from colluding in illegal surveillance of American citizens. He would filibuster such legislation. Yet, in mid-2008, just before he was, coronated at the convention in Denver, he voted for the FISA Amendments Act, which did precisely that, which indemnified the contractors. And I figured the fix is in. So I'm not going to assume any sort of sea change in policy. Now, it was only later that I learned that a certain John Brennan, a CIA official under Bush, had late in the Bush administration left the CIA and had become an advisor, foreign policy advisor, to Senator and presidential candidate Barack Obama. Brennan said later in an interview that he had, quote unquote, schooled Obama in foreign policy. Aside from that tone of headmasterly condescension, it kind of makes you wonder, is the tail wagging the dog? Who's running the show here?
You know, I want to bring up another example of a pretty famous individual where I think you could also wonder what happened, and that would be Colin Powell. And you look back to the Iraq War, it was his stature, his gravitas was used to sell that war. Pretty much after it was sold, it almost seems like he knows he was sold. He's kind of disappeared with his reputation in tatters. I wonder, when I look at that situation, because this was a guy that was really held out highly, and you wonder, well, did he know what was going down, or was he just, he fell on his sword for the deep state?
I'm not really surprised. Colin Powell has always sort of, during his career, maintained this sort of noblest Roman of them all persona, that he was above politics, simply a public servant. But I think what he did there at the UN was so egregious, and he knew the stuff was false, that he had to fall on his sword. But if you look back in his career, during Iran-Contra, he was the principal military advisor to the Secretary of Defense, Cap Weinberger. So he knew what was going on in Iran-Contra, knew about the arms diversions and all the skullduggery. and if you dial even further back when he was a mid-level officer in Vietnam, he was in the chain of command when a few whistleblowers reported the My Lai massacre. But you don't see him as the hero of the piece. You don't see or read about him at all. This is only known, you know, from subsequent research. So he's been involved in a lot of activities that were, say, not noble necessarily. And he somehow managed to keep his skirts clean. My own private theory, I can't prove it, is he was a very useful source for Bob Woodward. I noticed every time Powell had military duty where he was stationed in Washington, D.C., Bob Woodward wrote a book. And in the book, there's either anonymous sources dishing dirt, or if Colin Powell is mentioned, it's always in a very favorable context.
Two things left I'd like to dive in with you, Mike. Number one, as we're talking personalities, I'd like to go back to 1992, the election of Bill Clinton. And I want to bring that up to perhaps what you seem to be outlining, which will be the deep state's choice for this year, his wife as the next president. But let's go back in time a little bit on Clinton, because it's a really interesting situation. A guy coming from a small, I think many people might say, backwater state. I mean, kind of a state with definitely not a powerful state, but it was a state, and he used it as a platform. He got elected. And once he got in there, I mean, look, a lot of things happened. You had the dot-com bubble. You know, he had his intern dalliances. But the most interesting thing perhaps to me was the so-called liberal coming in. People called him the first black president. But that guy sure surrounded himself with Goldman Sachs about as fast as he possibly could. I mean, where was the Democratic Party? Where was those voters on the left? I mean, he did not exactly operate like a standard issue kind of bleeding heart liberal, did he? I mean, he seemed like he was fully engaged with Goldman Sachs.
Oh, he definitely was. Now, again, bringing up Bob Woodward, he wrote a book in the mid-90s about Clinton's first couple of years in office. He recounts some scene early in his first term where all these people are standing around. I think one of them's James Carville, and his economic advisors are telling him his infrastructure program to invest in America and all that sort of stuff is not going to work because it will send the wrong signal to the bond markets, which will raise interest rates, which will choke off any stimulus that the infrastructure program would have provided. So he looks at the group and says, "You mean my economic program is hostage to a bunch of effing bond traders?" And they said, "Yep, Mr. President, that's about the case." Very soon, he replaced Lloyd Bentsen as his Treasury Secretary with Robert Rubin from Goldman Sachs. He had other people in there like Larry Summers. I think during his term, he reappointed Alan Greenspan. And that troika pretty much ran the show for the benefit of Wall Street, lobbied for the repeal of Glass-Steagall, pretty much squashed Brooks Lee Bourne, who was head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, I think it was, when she wanted to regulate derivatives, because she foresaw what exactly happened with things like these synthetic CDOs. They blew up the economy.
What I think is really interesting, too, about the Clinton case, that'd be Bill and Hillary, is that once he steps aside, in the 15, 16 years once he stepped aside, the two of them, and I don't know for the life of me why Bernie Sanders keeps talking about a couple $100,000, because it's been fully reported that the two of them combined have made $153 million in speaking fees in the last 15 years. That is a phenomenal number for two people that were just a part of Arkansas and then literally in short order are well on the way to a family having a $1 billion net worth in the decades to come. And that's a sad tale for how things unfold, because once you get in there, and I think the Clintons have really led the way. They have shown, doesn't make a difference what party you're a part of, if you're willing to play ball and help the deep state go. They didn't get that $153 million just for shits and giggles. They got that $153 million because the deep state wanted something.
Sure, it was retroactive payment for services rendered. Perhaps Sanders uses it because big numbers sort of bounce off the consciousness of the American public, you know, like pebbles off an Abrams tank. As I recall earlier in my career in the 80s, it was a big scandal when Boeing charged the Pentagon $600 for a hammer. People understand that because they know you can buy a hammer for 20 bucks down at Home Depot. But when the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad under Paul Bremer lost track of $12 billion, you know, they don't know whether it's 12 million, 12 billion. They don't understand the order of magnitude. It's just so big that it has no meaning to their daily lives.
Mike, why do you think, let's look at the Democratic Party right now. Why do you think the Democratic Party is so split? I can look at the Sanders side of the equation. I see this on Facebook. I see really strong arguments. I see a very engaged electorate. They're going to rallies. They have a very strong message. They want to break up these banks on Wall Street. Some of that message, I mean, I think when Bernie Sanders talks about what happened on Wall Street, I don't care what partisan stripe or no partisan stripe you are, what Sanders talks about Wall Street is spot on. But I'm curious, when I look at the Clinton audience, how does this spell get cast over so many voters to just believe that this woman who stands there, and I saw she was introduced the other day by some congressman playing this Donna Summer song, "She Works Hard for the Money," not even realizing how insane that was as a lead-up song. She works hard for the money. Not really. So I'm looking at this, but what I don't understand is, how did we get a situation where there's this actively engaged Sanders audience, and then this Clinton audience, and it looks like she's probably going to win, and these people just trust her? What do they trust? What? It's like they've got a spell cast on them.
Why do working class people think Trump, the guy who set up Trump University and the main economic lesson it imparted was don't fall for a scam like Trump University? He's viciously fought unionization in his hotel on the Strip. The other hotels are actually unionized, and his workers get $3 an hour average less. He's run all kinds of stuff like that. He's run pyramid schemes. Sorry, I think that the politically correct term is multi-level marketing. Pyramid schemes to sell dietary supplements, and that went bust. So why do they think that this billionaire is going to solve their problems when he's had, you know, 4 corporate bankruptcies and a lot of shady deals? It's precisely for the same reason that women think Hillary Clinton is the cat's meow, that any criticism of her is Clinton derangement syndrome, and they just simply won't take cognizance of the fact that she had extremely poor judgment as Secretary of State with respect to Libya. She let herself get talked into that by Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, who was looking for oil concessions for his national oil companies. I think in both cases, it comes down to people being blinded by ideological labels and the fact that they're Democrats or Republicans first. I view myself as an American citizen first, but before even that, I view myself as a conscious, sentient being who owes an obligation to himself to learn what the facts are and follow the facts, not an ideology.
You just very astutely laid out the points that I think any of the never Trump hashtags would say. You laid them all out. But what I'm curious about, though, too, is that, and I might be included in this group, I'm kind of excited, though, when I watch so many Republicans literally having breakdowns over the rise of Trump. So many Republican leaders. There's a part of me that excites. It's not because I think Trump is a perfect candidate, but there is a side of me that's very excited that I can watch all of these people that have been telling me these things they're going to do that they never do, or why we need these wars and we really don't. There's a side of me that, and I think a lot of the people that are voting for Trump feel the same way. Like, it's almost like we don't really even care what his issues are. I'm not saying that's not saying my position, but it seems like a lot of people don't even care about his issues, really. It's more like, okay, we're kind of with him on this trade thing. We want America to be great, and everyone hates him on the Republican side, so let's vote for him.
Well, there's that. An acquaintance of mine, Bruce Bartlett, who was also a Republican operative who left the party, and I don't know whether he's an independent or still labels himself a Republican. He explained that he's voting for Trump precisely to destroy the Republican Party structure, the oligarchy that runs it, because it's so bad. He doesn't have any realistic expectation that he would be elected, but that he would destroy the party. Now, I think that's a nice theory. It's kind of like cheering on Adolf Hitler invading the Soviet Union. You know, they're both really bad, but, you know, the theory might be you want him to take out this other totalitarian power. But what happens if he succeeds?
That leads me to my last question. It seems like the deep state is so entrenched, it's really hard to imagine any big change, which, again, I think gets back to the Trump and Sanders thing, why there's excitement there and why there's traction, because people view them as big change. But I think if we were to sit down over a beer, I think you would basically say, Michael, the next president will be Hillary Clinton. So what's the end game for America? What, you know, how does the deep state, I mean, you've got some great points that you make in your book, some solutions, and I know they're hopeful. But if we really have to look at, let's say, the next 5 years, next 10 years, next 15 years, next 20 years, is there really anything on the horizon, Mike, where this deep state entrenchment goes away? I mean, do they really lose their grip? I don't see how they lose their grip.
Yeah, I wouldn't have foreseen Trump and Sanders a year ago. Now, Hillary will probably get reelected and try to extend the status quo.
I like how you say that, reelected.
Sorry, that's a Freudian slip. I guess it's the same old, you know, group of people. If she's elected, she will attempt to extend the status quo. But I don't think you can get the forces, back in the box that were left, you know, let out during this campaign. And I think time is going to be on the side of millennials who basically were screwed by the 2008 financial meltdown. They've grown up without all this cultural baggage of the culture wars from the 60s, the early baby boomers, of which I'm kind of a mid-boomer, the trailing edge of the silent generation, all that group that is now in their mid-60s to mid-70s, they've been saturated with this culture wars stuff for the last 50 years, and it's tiresome. And, you know, I, for one, the millennials get a lot of criticism as being slackers or whatever. They can't be any worse than baby boomers like Bill Clinton or George W. Bush, both very self-indulgent, self-centered individuals that just happen to be in different parties.
You know, I think you make a great point about Sanders and Trump and what they've really opened up is a window for all of us to see electorates, and maybe it's really just the same group, just frankly chasing two different people right now, Trump and Sanders. But you're right, I think other enterprising politicians in the future, as long as they, you know, have some sense of realism to them, I think other people are going to look at that audience, and I start to wonder, are we truly at the point I thought we might have been there back in the Perot days, but are we truly at the point where there really is a legitimate opportunity for a third party?
Yeah, third parties do not generally fare well in our system. More likely, the whole landscape is rigged against them. However, I think the better chance remains that improvements come through a takeover of one or both of the parties.
But the deep state's still going to own everything. When's that? That doesn't change anytime soon, does it?
If we were ever able to get the money out of politics, that would be the precursor. That's the precondition for any other reform.
Mike, it's really fascinating stuff. I appreciate you taking some time today. Is there anything from your perspective that you want to add? We've covered a lot of territory. I don't know if anything that you've been thinking about or writing about in the last few weeks or months that's really at the top of your mind right now.
Well, I think we pretty much covered the waterfront. All I could do is, you know, suggest to your listeners, pick up a copy of The Deep State, preferentially at your independent bookseller or Amazon or Barnes & Noble if you must.
Yes, and just to repeat that for everybody, The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And that's an interesting title, and it's provocative, but I think as we said at the beginning of this conversation, this is not a conspiracy theory. This is just going down the rabbit hole and making observations about where we are today.
Absolutely.
Mike, is there a website or anything, or just best to send everybody to the book?
There's the book, and I have my own website, www.mikelofgren.net.
Mike, thank you for the time today. Hopefully we can catch up on the backside of perhaps when the next crisis happens, and we can circle back and compare notes.
Well, I cringe at the next crisis, but I look forward in that event to talking with you.
I see a time when those awake will understand how to make money in up, down, and surprise markets. Whether new trader or experienced, college student or financial advisor, protecting against a crash or just trying to make a lot of money, trend following offers everyone an answer in uncertain times. To get started immediately, send me an email, michael@covell.com. I will send you the right trend following steps to take along with my free video. But if you want to buy and hold, trust the government and trust Wall Street, this is absolutely not for you.